Welcome back. Today, we will do quantum field theory while going from the Heisenberg to the Schrödinger picture. And let me quickly review what I mean by the Schrödinger picture here. How does the Schrödinger equation come about in first quantization? We're really doing two things when we do the Schrödinger equation in first quantization. And the first is that we write down the abstract Schrödinger equation. So we write down I h bar dt psi equal h hat psi. And that's the important bit here. Here the time evolution is in the states rather than the operators. And strictly speaking, this is what it means to go to the Schrödinger picture. But then in first quantization, the Schrödinger equation is obtained by also choosing a particular representation, which is usually the position representation. So this would be the first step. Namely, the time evolution is here. The second step is that we choose a particular representation, which is usually the position representation. So use psi of x and t, which is by definition x psi of t. And then we obtain that I h bar dt psi of x and t equal to h, which is now a function of x and of minus I d by dx acting on psi of x and t. And then usually this is what we consider to be the Schrödinger equation. So there are two steps that lead to this. We start with putting the time evolution into the states rather than the operators, and secondly, we choose the position representation. In quantum field theory, we can do the same thing. We can start with putting the time evolution into the states rather than the operators, and we can choose the equivalent of a representation like this, where we have in the first quantized case, position and momentum operators represented as multiplying with x and differentiating with respect to x. In the case of quantum field theory, it's a bit different. It looks different, but it's the same idea. There, the degrees of freedom are the phi, and so the phi will play the role of the x operator, and then the pi will play the role of the pi operator, and then the analog of this is going to be that phi is going to be represented, phi hat is going to be represented as multiplication with the field, and pi is going to be represented as minus I h bar differentiation with respect to the field. And in this way, we get a Schrödinger equation for quantum field theory. So that's what we will do today. This will give us another way to calculate the probability distribution for quantum fluctuations of quantum field theoretical states, such as the vacuum and states with multiple particles in it, and so on. Okay, so we start with the operator, the usual abstract second quantized formalism, and then from there we will do those steps, but second quantized. Okay, so what are we dealing with? Fields, which you can visualize just like the surface of a lake, as we said. And here, the degrees of freedom are the amplitudes at the locations here. So for every location x, we have a degree of freedom phi. And in the case of water, we would measure the degree of freedom by putting a cork in there and measuring how far up or down it is. So the phi of x and t is some amplitude field. So in contrast to first quantization, we have uncountably many degrees of freedom at first sight. That's what we have to deal with. In the quantum theory now, we have at every location x a quantum degree of freedom. So the amplitude of the field at every location here is a quantum degree of freedom, therefore quantum uncertain, and so on. Now, in the case of a lake and its waves, we can measure the amplitude at every location by putting a cork in there. In the case of a quantum field, how would we measure the amplitude of a field there? Well, one way to do this, as we will see in lecture 8 of this course, is to put the analog of a cork into the quantum field. And that analog could be, for example, an atom. Just like the cork may bob up and down, the atom exposed to a field, such as electromagnetic field, might get excited or de-excited. That would be the analog of the cork going up and down. So we will probe the dynamics of quantum fields by putting atoms into quantum fields. So basically, we will lay the foundations to describing the interaction between light and matter. And notice that this is going to be a hybrid where we do first and second quantization at the same time, because it would be super tedious to describe an atom in second quantization. So we will describe the atom in first quantization and the field in second quantization. We can do this, we can just add the Hamiltonians. As long as we stick to the rules of quantum theory, we can do this, as we will see. All right, so now assume that in the case of the lake, we have it filled with corks. So there's a cork everywhere. And then we take a snapshot, we take a photograph, and so we measure exactly what the altitude of every level of each of the corks is, and so we get a wave field, phi of x, at a particular point in time, t. For the quantum field, similarly, you could imagine measuring the amplitude of the field, such as the amplitude of the electric field or whatever, but in our case it's just a scalar field, at a given point in time, everywhere in space. Now, why would that be possible? It's consistent with the principles of quantum theory, simply because these phi hat operators are self-adjoint values, self-adjoint valued functions of x. And that's what we require of observables, that they are Hermitian or self-adjoint. And they are commuting with each other. Remember the commutation relations between the phi hat of x's, phi hat of x, phi hat of x prime, they all commute. So in principle, they are a commuting set of observables. We should be able to measure them all simultaneously. And we get for every one of these positions x, a real number as the measurement outcome. And so the outcome of all of those simultaneous measurements of the phi hat at all of the x's gives us a field of real values, just like measuring the height of all these corks. In fact, the set of all of those phi hat of x for all x, so the collection of all operators phi hat for all x, is a maximal set of commuting observables. You can't find any other observables in the quantum field theory that would commute with all of them and that are not functions of these. So they are a complete set. So as we said, at every x, we obtain a real valued measurement outcome. If we perform our measurement at a particular point in time, everywhere, then for every x, we obtain a measurement outcome. And that measurement outcome is a real number. And let us give a name to that real number. Let's call it phi of x. So for every x, the outcome of the measurement will be called phi of x. So the outcome of all these simultaneous measurements is some field configuration. That's how we call it. It's a field configuration, which is to say a specific function phi of x. That gives you at every x the outcome of the measurement of the amplitude there. And ultimately, what we want to be able to calculate at the end of this lecture today is for every field configuration phi of x, the probability amplitude for finding it. Right? So what's the probability amplitude for finding this configuration, or that the field does that, and so on, given the state of the quantum field? So for example, if the quantum field is in the vacuum state, then there ought to be a probability distribution for these functions phi of x. Each function phi of x has some probability density of being found. If the state of the quantum field is different than the vacuum, different state than the vacuum state, then there ought to be a different probability distribution for this phi of x. Technically, it's going to be a different probability amplitude distribution, of which we have to take the modulus square to get the probabilities. Now, that sort of thing you've seen, of course, before, like in first quantization. Remember what these guys are. Here you have psi of x and t is the probability amplitude for finding the particle at x, right? Now the degrees of freedom are different. They're no longer the x's. Now, these are the measurement outcomes, entire functions, phi of x. So we associate now a probability amplitude, not for one location x, but for an entire function phi of x. We're trying to calculate the probability amplitude for finding an entire function phi of x. So our wave function in quantum field theory is going to be not this, but something that we will write as psi with a capital psi of phi. So you plug in a field configuration and you get the probability amplitude for finding it. Since the state of the field, the quantum field, can change over time, this also depends on time t. This is the analog of that. So the probability amplitude for finding field configurations, so the probability amplitude distribution as a function of time. That's the wave function of quantum field theory. It's actually called a functionnel. A function takes a bunch of variables as input and outputs a number. A functionnel takes an entire function as input and outputs a number. So that's why we use square brackets and why we call it a functionnel. So this is a wave functionnel. So we will aim to calculate the Schrödinger equation that this wave functionnel of quantum field theory obeys. All right. So we start with the definition. We say that if phi is some field configuration, therefore it's some map from R3 into R, associating to every location some amplitude. So if phi is some field configuration, then we define a state in the Hilbert space of our quantum field theory that we call phi. And it's that state, by definition, which is such that if the quantum field is in that state, we are sure to find that field configuration. What's the analog in first quantization? Well, it would be like a position eigenvector. Right? The position eigenvector. Oh, here's the chalk. Position eigenvector x, let's say we put here 5 meters. If the system is in that state, the position is sure to be found 5 meters. So here, though, the degrees of freedom are entire field. And so the state, the ket state with the phi in it, is that state in which we are sure to find that field configuration. So technically, this means this is the joint eigenvector of all those operators phi hat of x with a collection of eigenvalues being exactly those values here. So we have that by definition of what this phi hat ket is, for what this phi ket is, if we take any one of the operators phi hat of x and apply it to this state here, then we find, hey, it's an eigenvector, and the eigenvalue for the operator at this particular x is phi of x. Now, we have here the label x, but similarly, in first quantization, we could also have a label, namely, for example, if we have x1, x2, x3, this is the joint eigenstate to the operators x hat 1 and x hat 2 and x hat 3. And in our case here, second quantization, we have all of those operators phi hat of x. And here this label runs, of course, all the way through R3. Right? So these guys are elements of R3. So for every point in R3, we have an operator here. And here we have x hat I, and this I usually runs in first quantization simply only from 1 to 3, if we have a particle in three dimensions. So this label I has only three possible values. And this is our degree of freedom. In quantum field theory, we have an uncountable, formally an uncountable number of operators labeled by this. And just like these guys are all commutative for all I, these are commutative for all x. So these can be jointly diagonalized. You can have joint eigenvectors of all three of those, and we write like this. And here we can have joint eigenvectors of all of those, and we write these joint eigenvectors like that, phi. So for every choice of function phi of x from R3 into R, we get a vector in the Hilbert space, phi, which has this property. So since it's an eigenvector, since this is a joint eigenvector to all of those operators, for all of the x, we are sure to find the outcome phi of x if the state of the system is this one. And that state is, of course, unique up to an overall phase. The overall phase, e to the power I alpha, could not be determined this way. Now, let's take a state other than this state phi here, right? So, I mean, we could take any arbitrary function from R3 into R, and then we get joint eigenvectors here. But just like in first quantization, these guys form a basis in the Hilbert space, formally speaking. Not every vector in the Hilbert space is one of those. A general vector in the Hilbert space is a linear combination of these guys. So similarly here in quantum field theory, for every choice of function phi of x, for every choice of field configuration phi of x, we get one of those vectors, and they diagonalize our field phi hat of x, because they are joint eigenvectors of all of these operators. So they form a basis in the Hilbert space, actually. Formally, there are some issues to do with the fact that this is continuously many degrees of freedom. So formally, they form a basis in the Hilbert space. But of course, a general state in the Hilbert space of our quantum field theory is going to be some linear combination. In general, some infinite linear combination with infinitely many coefficients of these basis vectors there. So one of those states that is not one of the phi, but is some linear combination of these guys, is going to be the vacuum state, for example. So for example, let's assume that the system is in the vacuum state phi. Sorry, vacuum state that we called omega. Then what is the typical measurement outcome if we measure all of the field operators phi hat of x, if we had measurement apparatuses to do this? What would be the typical measurement outcome? Remember, in order to get this state, we have to decompose the quantum field into harmonic oscillators and then look at the joint ground state of all those harmonic oscillators. That's what we call the vacuum state. So this is going to be some state in the Hilbert space, but it's not one of those eigenstates of the phi hat operators. So then what is the probability for, what is the typical measurement outcome? Well, a typical measurement outcome is going to look like this. We did this by other means in the previous lecture. We calculated the probability distribution for finding those outcomes, and this is one actually drawn from the probability distribution, and these are the level curves then. So that's one typical field configuration that can occur, that will occur if you prepare your quantum field in the state omega, and then you just keep measuring all the phi hat of x for all x, and then you prepare omega again, and then you measure again the phi hat of x's, you get a distribution of field configurations in this way. And that's a typical one that you can get, that you get there. Now, after you've done the measurement, so you prepared the vacuum state, but then you did the measurement. You measured the phi hat at every location. Well, then what is the state of the system then? Well, then it's in that eigenstate phi of the field configuration that we happened to find. It's just like a harmonic oscillator that starts out in the ground state, and then you perform a position measurement. But then it's no longer in the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. Then it's in the position eigenstate. So similarly here, we prepared the quantum field in the vacuum state, but then we measured all the phi hat amplitudes. So we ended up in a state that's in a phi hat eigenstate, that's a phi hat eigenstate, namely for the field configuration that we actually measured. Later we will see that these field configurations are impossible. If you actually could do this, if you had field eigenstates, you would find their energy would be infinite. You cannot measure a field everywhere with arbitrary accuracy for no other reason than it would be energetically too expensive. That's not the speciality of quantum field theory. It's also true in first quantization and in harmonic oscillators. If you prepare an ordinary first quantized harmonic oscillator in the ground state and then perform a position measurement, then you get the position eigenvector. But calculate the energy of a position eigenvector in a harmonic oscillator. It's infinite. It's infinite. Right? It's because the second derivative, the two spatial derivatives in the p squared term are not tolerant of a Dirac delta, right? Because two steep derivatives, it's not in the Gruber, it's infinite. So even in harmonic oscillator, you can't measure positions with arbitrary accuracy, just because you would need a measurement instrument that has arbitrarily an infinite amount of energy available. So that's not nothing. That's not anything new, but we have it in quantum field theory too, so let's keep that in mind. It's very idealized what we are saying. But as a matter of principle, of course, you could go more and more accurate, but you can never have the infinite precision. Which is actually helpful because the functional analysis wouldn't be well defined for all those phi hat if we all treated them as independent degrees of freedom. But let's not worry about the functional analytic subtleties at this point. Okay, so in principle, if we could measure all the phi hat with this tremendous accuracy, as accurate as we want, then we would get arbitrarily close to finding an eigenstate of the field operators. And therefore, after the measurement, the system is in that eigenstate that we measured, which is phi, for the field configuration that we happen to measure. So phi is, if you remember, joint eigenstate of all these operators that we measured. So we have that phi hat acting on that state that the system is now in is phi of x, that state again. So apart from this pesky little business with the infinite energy, what we have is that if we prepare a field in the vacuum state, then perform the measurements of the phi hat, then we are in that eigenstate. Therefore, if immediately we would measure that same measurement again, we measure again all the phi hat, we should find the same outcome because we are still in the same state here. And that state guarantees that we measure the same outcome, the same field configuration again. Just like if you prepare, if we measure the position in first quantization, a position of a particle now, and then measure right away again, we should find the same position. Of course, if we just wait a little bit, it would escape because it has such tremendous momentum uncertainty. Yep.
So in quantum mechanics, I get how you, I guess, measure the position of, let's say, a quantum particle, but what does it mean for you measure, like, field configuration?
Yes, that's a non-trivial business, and we'll get to that in lecture 8. I just wanted to allude to it earlier when I said that in the case of water waves, you would use a quark. In the case of quantum fields, you could use an atom. See, the atom will be sensitive to electromagnetic fields. And then you're not directly measuring the amplitude of a field, but you're measuring something that's very closely related to it. Yes, so let's continue the discussion once we have lecture 8. So now, how to calculate these things in the Schrödinger picture? Remember, that's our aim here. We want to do the analog of that in second quantization. We want to calculate the time evolution of the wave functional of quantum field theory. The wave functional being the tool that arises when you pick a state in quantum field theory. So you say, my quantum field is in a particular state. Then you get a wave functional associated to that. Just like in first quantization, if the system is in a state psi of t, you get a wave function psi of x and t. So here too, you have a quantum field theoretical state psi, and then you get a wave functional out of it. And that wave functional then allows you to calculate, I mean, to plug in any field configuration you want, and you get out a complex number, which is the probability amplitude for finding that field configuration. So that's what we are aiming at. So how to calculate now in the Schrödinger picture? How do we get there? Some preparations. Let's start with the Hilbert basis. The state of these joint eigenvectors of the field observables, phi hat, is formally like a Hilbert basis. Apart from some functional analytic issues that can be avoided, for example, by putting the system in a box and saying we have no wavelengths larger than such and such, and we have no wavelengths shorter than so and so, then you get a finite number of these degrees of freedom, and it's all correct, exactly what I'm saying. So let us start with the Hilbert basis given by these joint eigenvectors. Joint eigenvectors, the set of joint eigenvectors of a maximal set of commuting observables gives you a Hilbert basis, just like in first quantization, also in second quantization, because that's just a matter of functional analysis. It's not specific to quantum mechanics. Just a mathematical fact. Okay, so if we took all of those, so for each of the field configurations, then they form an orthonormal basis, a complete orthonormal basis or Hilbert basis of our Hilbert space, up to functional analytic subtleties. Now, just like the axes in first quantization form a Hilbert basis, which can then be used, of course, for a resolution of the identity. Namely, we can write the identity operator as the integral x dx. Here, we can do the same thing, just with way more degrees of freedom. Namely, we can now write a resolution of the identity in terms of these basis vectors. Now, in first quantization, we can use the resolution of the identity to do this. We can write x dx and apply that to a state psi. Okay, and this is then psi, right? Because this whole thing is just the identity. Okay, so what we obtain is that psi is a linear combination of, it is x and then x psi dx. But this is the wave function, psi of x. So therefore, we obtain that the state can be written as the integral psi of x, x dx. So all we did here is that we expanded x you expanded the state, an arbitrary state in first quantization, in terms of the position eigenbasis. Okay? And we did that by using the resolution of the identity provided by this basis. Same thing we can do here. So here we have an arbitrary state in our quantum field, of our quantum field theory. Could be the vacuum state, could be whatever state. And then we want to expand it in this basis. So what we do is, is we path integrate, or we functionally integrate, over all phi. See, that's non-trivial now, because we have to choose all field configurations, all possible field configurations, and integrate over them. Formally, we can write something like all phi out of the square integrable functions from R3 to R. Technically, nobody quite knows how to do this accurately. But again, if you put your system into a finite size box so that there are no wavelengths larger than so-and-so, so you have an infrared cutoff, and you also implement an ultraviolet cutoff by stipulating that we're not considering any wavelengths shorter than a certain amount, then you only have a finite number of modes, only a finite number of wavelengths at all. And then it turns out that this functional integral actually becomes just a bunch of finitely many ordinary integrals, because your function space is now parameterized by finitely many parameters. It's just like a Fourier series that you truncate, right? A Fourier series you get by putting an infrared cutoff, and then an ultraviolet cutoff you get by saying no wavelength shorter than so-and-so. So you have a truncated Fourier series in three dimensions. And that means all functions that can be described by this three-dimensional Fourier series are linear combinations of these finitely many plane waves. Therefore, the entire function space is parameterized by finitely many parameters. So integrating over the entire function space just boils down to integrating over a finite number of parameters, which is something we can do. However, it's tedious, of course, to always drag along the infrared cutoff and the ultraviolet cutoff and all the specifications that come with that. So therefore, it's much more convenient and clearer to write it as a formal functional integration, even though we should always keep in mind that the math of the limit taking that you would have to do of the removal of the infrared and ultraviolet cutoff is not settled. In fact, probably at the short distances, new physics will kick in. It's basically everybody believes that, yes, there ought to be Planck scale physics where gravity necessarily comes in and so on. And for the large scales, in any case, gravity comes in as well, because then it's all curved space and so on. So as long as we do experiments that are not at the extremely small and extremely large scales, nothing bigger than the size of the universe that we see, nothing smaller than the 10 to the minus 21 meters that we can measure, for example, at CERN, at the LHC, there everything is well defined because we have an ultraviolet and infrared cutoff, and this is just finitely many integrals. Okay, so with this caveat, this is the resolution of the identity. Therefore, an arbitrary state of our quantum field can be written in this way, resolution of the identity acting on our state. And this capital D indicates, be careful, this is this business that really requires infrared and ultraviolet regularization. But apart from that, it's exactly what we have on the blackboard too. We have an arbitrary state which we expand in a Hilbert basis, in an orthogonal basis. And therefore, this bit here, which is the projection of the actual state of the field onto the basis vectors one by one, because we are integrating over all phi, that thing is the quantum field theoretical wave functional. Just like here. The actual state of the first quantized system inner producted with the position eigenvector, so our basis vectors, first quantization, that overlap is the probability amplitude for finding x if psi is prepared. That is psi of x, the wave function. And here too, this is the probability amplitude for finding the field configuration phi if the state psi is prepared. So this is the wave functional here. It's this. This is phi psi of t. Okay? So that's what we want to calculate.
Basically, the state is describing the whole fluctuation or field configuration.
Yeah, given the state of a quantum field, you have a probability amplitude for every field configuration to be found. So if, for example, the state is the vacuum state, then you can calculate now what the probability amplitude is for finding the field in such a way that its amplitude form the pattern of letters that write out Perimeter Institute. Right? As a field configuration where the field is everywhere zero except where the P is and the E and the R and so on, that's where the amplitude is one or whatever, right? That's a field configuration. And you can calculate the probability amplitude for finding it, or the probability amplitude density for finding it. Just like this is a probability amplitude density, you have to integrate over a little bit of dx to get a finite finite probability. Similarly here, the probability for finding an exact field is zero. You have to integrate a little bit, which is to say you have to path integrate, you have to functionally integrate a little bit. You have to consider a finite volume in the function space to actually get a probability there. But in principle, you can do that. Yes, so for whatever the state of the quantum field is, you can ask, what's the probability amplitude for finding the field configuration that spells out Perimeter Institute somehow, right? And in some field configurations, in some states of the quantum field theory, this is more likely, in other states it's less likely. For example, this field configuration has its own eigenstate, and if the field were prepared in that eigenstate, the probability for finding that field configuration is 1. And the probability for finding any other field configuration would be 0, right? Okay, so the wave functional. I already have it on the board, but let's just quickly go it. So regarding quantum mechanics, if the q hat of I are a complete set of commuting observables, such as position operators, with joint eigenvectors q, so q hat I acting on q is qi q, then the function psi given by psi of q, which is this overlap of psi with the eigenvectors, is called the wave function of psi in the q hat basis. Right? So remember, from first quantization, this is still true in second quantization, that there's a huge difference between a quantum state and a wave function. A quantum state is a vector in the Hilbert space. And a wave function is a representation of it in a particular basis. So psi is a state in a Hilbert space. But psi x is a collection of numbers. It's a function where you plug in x and you get out the probability amplitude. That's the wave function. So to go from state to wave function, you just put a basis vectors in there. And the same is true in quantum field theory, except that we changed the language a bit from function to functional, because the input is now no longer just, you know, a bunch of numbers like x1, x2, x3, but the input now is an entire field configuration. So you're plugging in a function to get a number out, and anything in mathematics where you plug in a function to get a number out is typically called a functional. So in quantum field theory, the phi hat of x are a complete set of commuting observables with joint eigenvectors, phi hat of x acting on this joint eigenvector is giving you these eigenvalues. We had all that already on the board there. And so the wave functional to the state psi is given by this. Basically, that's this equation again. Okay, so the wave functional capital psi of phi is a complex number It's the overlap between the actual state that you prepare the system in and the state that you're looking for, the field configuration, the state to the field configuration that you're looking for. So that's the wave function now.
So should there be a key there?
Yes, there ought to be. Yeah. If you want a time evolution to be in the states. But of course, you could use the Heisenberg time evolution picture, and then you can drop the T there. But then, of course, the basis vectors would change over time, right? Because if the observable is an operator that changes over time, then its eigenvectors and eigenvalues may change over time. Actually, the eigenvalues cannot change over time, but the eigenvectors can change over time. See, a unitary operation can never change the spectrum of a self-adjoint operator. It can only change the basis vectors, but not the spectrum. It's a little calculation that you can do sometime. Okay, so what is the interpretation then of this wave functional? Assume a system is in an arbitrary state, capital psi in the Hilbert space at time t. Then if we are measuring all those observables phi hat, I feel I'm repeating myself. I was just trying to be super careful earlier, and I'm already I was anticipating everything I had prepared anyway. So if measuring now all the field observables phi hat of x for all x, then we can ask what's the probability amplitude for finding a particular field configuration given by a function phi of x. And that is written in this way, the probability for the transition from psi to phi. So we prepare the system, the quantum field in the state psi. Then what's the probability for finding, if measured, the field configuration phi is given by that overlap, prepare psi, look for phi, the probability amplitude, you square that. So this is the wave functional modulus squared. This is the probability, or actually the probability density, for finding that particular field configuration. Now, remember, our aim is to do the full Schrödinger picture here, which is to say, having the time evolution in the states and having the representation just like the position representation of first quantization, except it's not going to be position representation here, it's going to be a phi representation. Because what are the position operators in first quantization are the field operators in second quantization. The basic observables are the phi now. So we want the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation. Even though underlying all of this, we are dealing with the Klein-Gordon equation, right? But the Schrödinger equation is more general. It transcends Dirac equation, Schrödinger equation, and Maxwell equations, and so on. All of them can be generated by a Schrödinger equation with a suitable Hamiltonian. The Schrödinger equation is not really to be viewed as a wave equation. It's simply saying, if you want to know what the time evolution is, ask the Hamiltonian. In other words, the Schrödinger equation simply says there exists an operator, a self-adjoint operator, that generates time evolution. That's abstractly what the Schrödinger equation does. In first, in second quantization, in millionth quantization, if you want to go that far. Right? So this equation is true in first quantization, second quantization, anywhere. It simply says the time evolution is generated by an operator that we call the Hamiltonian and is supposed to be self-adjoint, so that the time evolution operator, when integrated, so this is the generator of time evolution, when integrated up, you get a unitary time evolution. The point is, this has to be self-adjoint, so that the whole thing is unitary, and we know what unitarity means. It means conservation of angles, conservation of lengths, and in particular, it means conservation of probabilities. If the probabilities sum up to one before, they sum up to one afterwards. Which is why the potential loss of unitarity in black hole physics is so concerning. Because it would mean that information could be destroyed in a physical process. Okay. So, for every quantum theory, we have the Schrödinger equation. Which form does it take for our wave function L of quantum field theory. Here we have it abstractly for the Hilbert space vectors, just like we have it here. But in first quantization, we can make it concrete by writing it like this. For example, if the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus 1 half omega squared x squared, well, then the x hat gets replaced by multiplying with x, and the p hat gets replaced by minus id by dx, and the whole thing becomes very concrete, becomes a partial differential equation and so on. So here, too, we want to make that concrete. So which form does the Schrödinger equation take explicitly, concretely, if we choose a basis for these wave functionals? And the basis we're going to choose is the basis we already have, the basis of the joint eigenbasis of all the phi hat operators. Just like here, this is happening in the joint eigenbasis of all the x hat operators in the position representation. Now we're going to do this in the joint eigenbasis of all the phi hat operators in the field representation. So in which form does the Schrödinger equation now take? Well, let's start with the abstract Hamiltonian here. Abstract Hamiltonian before we can go to the concrete one. So the abstract Hamiltonian we already had in the previous lecture. The Hamiltonian is pi hat squared plus phi hat of x, and then we have minus Laplacian plus m squared phi hat again. Since we are working in the Schrödinger picture of time evolution, all the time dependence is in the states and in the wave function L. And the pi operators, pi hat of operators, are now frozen in time, and so are the phi hat operators. They're frozen in time. So the Hamiltonian is constant, it's a constant operator. So how shall the phi hat and the pi hat of x act on wave functionals psi of phi and t? See, the abstract, in first quantization, the abstract Hamiltonian has x hats and p hats in it. And we need to find out how the x hat and the p hat act on our wave functions psi of x and t. And the answer is that the x acts as multiplication by x, and the p acts as minus I d by d derivative with respect to x, right? So the analog of that here is now what? Let's see. We need to represent the commutation relations of quantum field theory. Just like here, we had to represent x hat, p hat equal I h bar. And the representation of that is in the following. If we say that x hat acting on psi of x equal to x psi of x, and we say that p hat acting on psi of x, and I'm putting this dot here to indicate acting on, then we say that this is minus I h bar dx psi of x. And I can check that this is a valid representation of that, right? If I, so the claim is that x minus I h bar dx minus I h bar dx x acting on psi of x, well, and t is equal to I h bar psi of x and t, right? Now, if you work that out, you will find that here we have a derivative on psi, and then we multiply with x. Here, we first multiply with x, and then we differentiate, which means we get two terms. One where the derivative acts on psi, and then we multiply with x by the product rule. These terms go away. And then we have a term where the d by dx acts on the x and leaves the psi the same. That is this term. So what we see is that the guess that these abstract operators can be represented concretely as multiplication and differentiation is correct. We can. This is a valid representation of the canonical commutation relations. That's why X is taking the form of multiplication and the P is taking the form of minus I h bar d by dx. I'm making that point because if you read textbooks on quantum mechanics, you find sometimes that people will say things like x and p become replaced by x and minus id by dx. And then you might wonder, what? How did that happen? How did p become a derivative? Of course, it's not a replacement. The mathematical structure is representation. You see, we have the abstract x and p, which obey commutation relations. That's all we know about them. But we can't do many calculations with it. In order to do actual calculations, we need to represent them as actual things that we can actually calculate stuff with. So we need to find things like matrices. And if we found 5x5 matrices that obeyed these commutation relations, we would use them. But you know, as we discussed early in the first lecture, you can't have 5x5 matrices that obey these commutation relations. Because if you take the trace on the left-hand side, it would be zero for the product of two matrices, because under the trace, x and p would be commutative, right? And on the right-hand side, you get ih bar times, well, here's the identity operator, right? So times the dimension of the Hilbert space from the trace. So you get 0 equal to ih bar times the dimension of the Hilbert space. So there cannot be any finite dimensional representations. That's why we have to look beyond that. There are infinite dimensional representations. There are infinite by infinite matrices that obey these commutation relations that you can write down. If you look up my lecture notes, you will find concrete representations of that. But there are other representations too. For example, x represented as multiplication, p represented as minus ih bar d by dx as operators. And these representations allow us then to perform explicit calculations because this abstract Schrödinger equation becomes a partial differential equation that we can plug in the computer and solve numerically if we can't do it analytically. So it becomes very concrete. Now, one concern, of course, is this. Abstractly, we have just this commutation relation. Now, it could be that there are many different representations of these guys, and that each representation describes a different physics. Which one is the right one then? Now, fortunately, there's a theorem by Stone and von Neumann, which says that, never mind, they're all the same. All of the representations, all of the valid representations of these canonical commutation relations differ only by a change of basis in the Hilbert space. So you always get the same physics. That's not trivial. For example, for the angular momentum commutation relations, you get many non-unitarily equivalent representations. Because there's, for example, spin 10 representations, spin 1/2 representations, and so on, they are not unitarily equivalent. But these guys, and they describe different physics, as they should. Right? The molecule that has a large span of angular momentum is a different thing than an electron that has only spin 1/2. But these commutation relations have unique representations, and that's what we work with. Okay, so this is where this comes from. And then, of course, you could also represent the x as ih bar d by dp and p as multiplication with p. Check the commutation relations, they come out right, it's a valid representation. And then by Stone von Neumann's theorem, we know it's the same thing, same physics. What is the unitary transformation, by the way, between the two? Do you know? Exactly. The Fourier transform is the unitary transformation from the eigenbasis of the x to the eigenbasis of the p. You know, eigenbasis, because, you know, if you represent x as multiplication by x, that means you're in the x eigenbasis. And if you represent p as multiplication by p, you must be in the p eigenbasis. Yeah. All right, so after this reminder, get back to business and do this in the case of second quantization. So here our task is to represent these canonical commutation relations. And they are a much more tricky animal here because we have a Dirac delta rather than a Kronecker delta over there. But again, if you put your system in a large box and you say no wavelengths larger than this, and also no wavelengths shorter than 10 to the minus 22 meters or whatever, then you have only finitely many of these guys. It turns out, after you do the Fourier series decomposition that I will show you much more about later on, and then this reduces just to a finite number of the ordinary commutation relations. And therefore, Stone von Neumann then still applies. But you have to use infrared and ultraviolet regularization to get that. Okay, but we don't want to always carry around infrared and ultraviolet regularizations because they're so tedious. But sometimes we'll have to do it, and we will get to that in a few slides. So formally, these are the commutation relations that we have to obey. What would be a suitable representation? Well, let's try to do what we did in first quantization. And we use the eigenbasis of the phi, because the phi hat of x played the role of the x hat of I. You know, the x hat of I running from 1 to 3, had I as a label. Here, this phi hat have the x as a label. So we use the eigenbasis of these. So very similarly to how we did it here, we represented x, the x hat operator, as multiplication with x, and the p hat operator as minus I h bar d by dx. Here we are representing phi hat of x as multiplication with phi of x. And we are representing pi hat of x as acting on the wave function L as minus I h bar d by d phi of x. Now, I'm using this curly d here to indicate that this is a functional derivative, like the functional derivative that you use to derive the Euler Lagrange equations, for example, from the action. Same thing. And again, if you use an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, these become a set of ordinary derivatives. But again, we don't want to carry that luggage around all the time, so we write it succinctly in this way using the functional derivatives. Okay, so we have multiplication and differentiation, functional differentiation. And just like you can check that this is true, and therefore we have xp minus px acting on psi is ih bar, same thing here. All you need to know here is that the product rule still applies for the functional derivatives, and that d by d phi of phi is a Dirac delta. That's how the functional derivatives are defined. So, having verified then that we have now a representation of our canonical commutation relations, we can now use them to make our abstract Hamiltonian a concrete Hamiltonian. Just like we went here from the abstract Schrödinger equation to the concrete Schrödinger equation by replacing all occurrences of x in the Hamiltonian by multiplication operators with x, and all occurrences of p in the Hamiltonian by minus I h bar d by dx. Here too, we take the Hamiltonian that we used to have, here, this one, and we replace all occurrences of pi hat by functional differentiation with respect to phi, and all occurrences of phi hat by multiplication with phi. So this Hamiltonian then becomes that Hamiltonian. You see how this used to be pi hat squared. This used to be pi hat squared, but pi hat is first functional derivative, pi hat squared is second functional derivative, and the I, or the minus I, after you do it twice, gives you just a minus sign. And then what used to be multiplication, what used to be the operator phi hat of x becomes just multiplication with x, because we are in the eigenbasis of, we are in the field eigenbasis now. So what you see is, this is now a representation of the Hamiltonian in the eigenbasis of the fields. And this thing is ready and asking for being applied onto a wave function L. This no longer acts on a Hilbert space vector. This thing acts now on a wave function L. Just like this Hamiltonian here cannot act on a Hilbert space vector. It acts on a wave function. Right? It needs a psi of x to multiply with x, to differentiate with respect to x. So here too, this thing is asking to be acting on a psi hat of phi and t. So the psi hat of phi and t is some functional of phi. In the simplest case, it might be a polynomial in the phi or something. And then you see what the Hamiltonian does. It will multiply with phi. I mean, like this thing might be a polynomial, for example, and it will multiply with the phi, but it will also functional differentiate with respect to the phi. You should think of the wave functional as something concrete. We will later see what it is explicitly for the vacuum. Something where you can plug in a field and you get out a probability amplitude, right? Okay. Now, to make these things concrete, let's work actually in the case of infrared regularization, because then I'm hoping that it will be a little bit more comfortable for you, because it's not a functional derivative, but it's ordinary derivatives that we get in this case. So, there we go. Okay, so what we want to do now is Fourier transform the whole thing so that we work in momentum space. When we work in momentum space, then remember that the field is no longer dependent on x, it's dependent on k, and the canonically conjugate field also is dependent on k. And remember that in principle, after Fourier transform, we have phi hat of k, but for some historical reason, the notation is that we write the k as a subscript, even though it's really just an argument. So what we have here is phi of k commutated with pi hat of k is this thing. And the wave functionals are now taking as input the field configurations after Fourier transformations. So they're now taking as input phi tildes, which is phi tildes of k rather than phi of x's. But it's equivalent, right? I mean, if we know a field as a field of phi of x, then we can Fourier transform it. We know it in phi of k. If we know it as phi of k, we know it as phi of x. Okay. So now, what we have to represent are the commutation relations in momentum space in terms of functional derivatives. So we write phi hat of k acting on the wave functional is multiplication with the phi tilde of k with the wave functional, and the pi hat acts again as functional differentiation, but we can now write it as an ordinary differentiation. The reason is that we work in the setup where we have not just momentum space, but we work in a finite size box. Therefore, not all values of k are legal, but we have a discretization of momentum space. I hope you remember that if you study physics in a box, then momentum space becomes discretized, because not all plane waves obey the boundary conditions, such as periodic boundary conditions or Dirichlet boundary conditions. This is a subset of them, which is a discrete grid in momentum space. And therefore, since we have not a continuum of k values, but a discrete set of k values, these are ordinary derivatives here. And therefore, it's just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, only way more of them, but not uncountably many more of them. But it has the advantage that we don't have a Dirac delta anymore, we have a Kronecker delta. Now, if you remember, there was an issue when we went from position space to momentum space, which is that we don't have delta of k and k prime, we have delta of k and minus k prime. And that used to be an issue which we addressed in the previous lecture with some methods that involved introducing these new harmonic oscillators, etc. Now it's very easy. It turns out that all we have to do is find a representation of these commutation relations, and this works. We represent the phi hat as multiplication and the pi hat as differentiation, but differentiation with respect to phi of minus k. That's all we need to do. And then if you plug that into here, you find that, yes, the canonical commutation relations are obeyed. So we found a valid representation, didn't need to do any complicated tricks here. So now we are ready for the Schrödinger equation. Because we have expressed our Hamiltonian now in this form. This thing, if you remember, this used to be the p hat squared, but in momentum space, in a box, so that the k, they take discrete values, we are summing rather than integrating over momentum space. We're summing over this discrete grid in momentum space. So this used to be minus 1/2 p hat squared, and that used to be the phi of x here and phi of x there, but after Fourier transform, the Laplacian has become a k vector squared, and is number valued. So we can put them together. We don't have to put them on one side or on the other side because there's no more derivative in this. And in the previous way of doing things, we were saying that by doing the Fourier transform, we decoupled the degrees of freedom. And that's what we see here as well. So we have the Hamiltonian now, not as an operator acting on Hilbert space, but as a concrete differential operator that acts on a functional space, or in fact on a function space, because we have a discrete set of k's, we can view this as a function again. You don't have to call it a functional anymore, because we just have this discrete number of Fourier coefficients. Okay, so here we have the Schrödinger equation, Hamiltonian ready to act on the wave functions. And here's the time derivative of the wave functions. This is completely the analog of that for first quantization. Now, in first quantization, what is the wave function of the ground state? Now, the wave function of the ground state is this one, except that I have a typo in there. I think there needs to be 1/2 here as well. So the wave function of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is this one. And notice the time dependence, because we are working in the Schrödinger picture, so the wave function and the state have time dependence. Now, in the case of the quantum field theory, you would expect something very similar. Now, what's the analog of the x? The x in first quantization, in second quantization, the role of that, of the actual degree of freedom, is played by the phi. In momentum space, by the phi tildes. So instead of the x squared, we expect something like phi tilde squared. Actually, this phi tilde k, phi tilde minus k. And then other than that, it's the same thing here, also with the time dependence. So this is not a derivation, this is a claim. And claiming that this beautiful thing here is the wave function of the Klein-Gordon quantum field theory for the vacuum state in Minkowski space. How can we check that? What do you have to do to check that this is the right wave function? Now, before we get to that, what can we do with it? Well, we should be able to plug in any field configuration we want and get out the probability amplitude for finding it. This should give us the probability distribution for all possible field configurations. So, let's say you cook up a field configuration like phi of x, which is a function from R3 into R, which is such that the field is everywhere zero, except somewhere in space it spells out with its amplitude Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. Okay, so this is a field configuration. So you have a phi of x. How do you find the probability amplitude now for finding that field configuration? Well, you Fourier transform the phi of x in the box to get the Fourier coefficients phi tilde of k. Right? So the phi of x was a function from R3 into R. And now you get these Fourier coefficients. If you have an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, then you have no wavelengths larger than so-and-so, no wavelengths smaller than such-and-such, which means you get a finite size picture of this writing of Bremer Institute for Theoretical Physics. And also, the writing is a little bit fuzzy. There are no exact sharp corners in there, because you don't have wavelengths shorter than a certain amount. And just to be safe, finite number of degrees of freedom. So we have infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, which means you only have a finite number of these k's, therefore only a finite number of these coefficients. It could be a huge number, but it's finite. Okay, so you have all those coefficients. Plug them in here. Plug them in here, work out what the sum is, and then exponentiate that e to the power minus of what that sum is, and then you get the probability amplitude out of it. Now that is that normalization factor we don't know in principle. That's like, this is like the Boltzmann factor for finding it, and then that is here the partition function by which this is 1 over the partition function that you would have to divide by. So what this formula gives you right away is the relative probability amplitudes. What's more likely than what else? But if it's a finite number of k values, then you can actually sum up all the probabilities and divide by the partition function in order to normalize the probabilities. So this is the complete answer. It gives you, for every field configuration, the probability for finding it. So in particular, you can now create these plots that I showed you already of these quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. This is the probability distribution, and you simply need to draw from it. And in some software packages, you can simply tell the software, this is my probability distribution, give me 1,000 random numbers, or sets of random numbers drawn from that probability distribution, so that what I get is more or less likely according to the probability distribution. And so the machine might give you a set of phi tilde of k values drawn from that probability distribution. Now, most software packages have uniform distributions built in, so you can draw random numbers between 0 and 1, equally distributed between 0 and 1. That wouldn't be good enough here, right? No, we can't just choose the values phi tilde of k between 0 and 1 uniformly. No, they have to run between minus infinity and plus infinity with this Gaussian type of probability distribution. And I will write something up about how you can draw from arbitrary probability distributions in case you don't have software that does that for you. You might find easily software that does it for Gaussians, where they say, tell me what the width of your Gaussian is, and then I give you random numbers from that probability distribution. But imagine that the harmonic oscillator is not in its ground state. It's an excited state, and the probability distribution is different. Here too, this is just one solution to that Schrödinger equation. See, this is like the Schrödinger equation for the harmonic oscillator. There's more than one solution to it, right? There are lots of eigenvectors to the Hamiltonian, and the full solution space is linear combinations of solutions. And this is just the lowest energy solution to this one. And you can look at solutions which are more complicated and that describe excitations of the various harmonic oscillators. It's actually not too hard to do here, because by doing the Fourier transform, we really did us a favor, because we decoupled the problem. And that's because here we have that the k and minus k always occur together. It's just like 1 degree of freedom, and then all the other k don't care about that. So this thing really separates out into independent harmonic oscillators. And therefore we can see that we can just choose one of these k's and have an excitation sitting there. Like the harmonic oscillator there might be in the fifth excited state or the 100th excited state, whereas all the others are still in the vacuum state. This gets me to how you would prove that this is a solution to that. Do you all see how you would have to do this? it shouldn't be too strange, because while we started out with a functional Schrödinger equation that has functional derivatives in it, by doing the Fourier transform and putting the thing in a box, we got discrete momenta, therefore ordinary derivatives, and this is in fact an ordinary differential equation. No, not an ordinary, it's a partial differential equation for many variables, but it's just the usual kind of differential equation, no functional stuff going on with the uncountably many degrees of freedom or anything. So literally all you have to do is plug that ansatz into here and see what happens. So for example, if you plug this here on the left, then what do you get? You get a time derivative of the functional. Well, let's look at it. Where's time dependence here? Well, only here. So you get down a omega k half. Okay? On the right hand side you have multiplication with this, so fine, we can just multiply that. But then here we have derivatives, ordinary derivatives with respect to the phi tildes and phi tilde k and phi tilde minus k. You get two terms and then you get some cancellations going, and at the end of the day you find, yeah, it solves the equation. But it's not the only solution. Just like the harmonic oscillator, one individual harmonic oscillator wouldn't just have one solution. No, it has, you know, the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator has many eigenfunctions, and they're all of the form of Hermite function times Gaussian. Right? So the nth eigenset of the harmonic oscillator is always the nth Hermite function times the Gaussian. Try this. Put here a Hermite function, suitably in the argument, these phi tildes, and then the Gaussian, plug it in there and see if it works. And then you have more solutions to the function, to the Schrödinger equation of second quantization of quantum field theory. And that means you get a different wave function that solves the problem, which means a different state of the quantum field that obeys the abstract Schrödinger equation. Remember, that was the whole point. We have here the abstract Schrödinger equation. We rewrite it in a concrete form so that we get the psi of x and t. But the psi of x and t represents an abstract vector psi of t. Right? And so if this we obtain by solving a partial differential equation, then from that we obtain this. Right? By this. That's a relationship. Abstract state. And here we have the wave function, we have the basis vectors. So once we solve the Schrödinger equation numerically or analytically or whatever, the concrete Schrödinger equation, then we get back the abstract solution in this way. So by solving the concrete Schrödinger equation with some concrete solution, we can go into this, or the analog of that for quantum fields, resolution of the identity. We have the equation up there. We can then work out what the abstract solution is. So in this way, you obtain the time evolution of abstract states in your quantum field. And from that, you can calculate how the probability distributions for finding this or that field configuration change over time. And of course, you can then not only calculate the probability distribution for field configurations, but you can calculate anything. Because if you have your wave function, any observable is fair game. You can calculate what the expectation value of it is. Just like when you have the Schrödinger equation solved, you have the psi of x and t, you can use that solution to calculate momentum expectation values or angular momentum expectation values. No problem. Once you have the solution, everything else is calculable. Same here. Okay, so if you remember, we've actually seen this before. We derived it earlier. Except we didn't have the time dependence in it. But other than that, we had this earlier by decomposing the quantum field into harmonic oscillators, which we then solved individually using the Heisenberg picture. Now we did in effect the same thing. We just used the Schrödinger picture and the equivalent of the position representation, which is here the field representation. Right, and so generic wave functionals, and I think that's the almost the last thing, generic wave functionals. Assume the system is in a state alpha, which may not be the vacuum state. Then that means that for at least some mode oscillators, if we decompose the field into harmonic oscillators, our state is not the ground state. But if an oscillator is excited, then its wave function spreads out. So classically, the amplitude for oscillations would increase. And therefore, the picture that we obtain if we draw from the probability distribution would change. Now, this is an argument that I think already alluded to last time. If a harmonic oscillator is in its ground state, the probability distribution is simply Gaussian. And it can be a fairly narrow Gaussian or fairly wide Gaussian, depending on how steep the potential is. But let's say it's some Gaussian. And now, let's look at the same harmonic oscillator, but in the 1 millionth excited state. Now, the particle is way more likely to be found way out there, because it's like classically it would be much larger amplitude. So the probability distribution now looks more like this, right? So it grows polynomially with a high power initially until the Gaussian eventually kills it off. And if we draw from that probability distribution, we are unlikely to find low amplitudes. We are much more likely to find large amplitudes, but not very large amplitudes, just where the peak is, right? And that means that if one of those mode oscillators, let's say for the mode K, is in a very highly excited state, then the probability distribution for that mode oscillator is such that we are very likely to find quite significantly large numbers for phi K. And that means that when we then do the Fourier transform back to phi of x, then all the phi k's will have the usual small amplitudes, but this particular mode that's highly excited will have a typically very large amplitude. And that will show in the picture. If we then draw from the probability distribution, we get the usual vacuum fluctuations noise, but we get one plane wave from the inverse Fourier transform with a very large amplitude. So we will have a large plane wave, and on top of that, the usual quantum fluctuations. It's something that you may want to recreate in your project. So here's a picture of the probability distribution for the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. Here's a highly excited state where the probability distribution has a dip in here, and then it's much more likely to find larger amplitudes for phi k. Right, okay, and I will talk more about these things in the project description, which will go online sometime soon. Okay, any questions? Yeah?
So this second quantization is with the S and the P is the algebra and observables. Can you do a second quantization with respect to the rotation group, SU2? Is that making sense?
I'm not sure I understood what the first thing you said. So we do second quantization based on X and P. What do you mean by that?
Like our observables that be powers of x and p, right?
No, why would they be powers of x and p? What do you mean? I mean, what we have is that we have the field phi hat, and we have an operator phi hat for every value of x, for all of the x vectors, right? So the x vectors are now labels for these operators phi hat.
Right.
You're thinking that in the field theory, the phi's are now your operators, that's your algebra, is your phi.
Yeah.
Okay, so what you could do, maybe that's what you meant. Okay, so we can, of course, also work with the phi hat of p, as we did, right? So we went from choosing the three position vectors as the as defining the space over which we define our fields, right? We can also have our phi hat live over momentum space instead. It's the same physics, but we could not only write phi hat of the p, phi hat tilde of the p, but another set of commuting observables might be, for example, I don't know, L1, L hat squared, and well, now it gets difficult because we can't use a Hamiltonian here. But some other operator Q that commutes with L1 and L squared Q. And then we can write our quantum fields as quantum fields living on L1, L squared, and Q. And we get the same quantum field theory. Because it's just a reformulation. Just like we go from position to momentum space by unitary transformation, we can also go by any other unitary transformation in the space of classical fields to these. So we still have the arbitrariness of first quantized representations available to choose where our fields live on, whether we write them on position space, momentum space, or some more abstract space. It doesn't matter. So the answer is, I guess, yes, we can do it. It's the same physics, though. Just like it's the same whether we work in position or momentum space. Okay? Well, if there are no further questions, see you on Tuesday.